Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, May 6, 2022. Labor Department says 428,000 jobs were created in April in the U.S., unemployment rate staying at 3.6%. We'll hear from President Joe Biden, who's in Ohio to tour a manufacturing plant, and talk with Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Mitchell. Leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would overturn the constitutional right to an abortion continuing to spark protests and concerns about the safety of the justices. White House and a Republican member of Congress give their take. More questions to the Pentagon about what intelligence it's providing to Ukraine to help in the war against Russia, now involving the sinking of that Russian warship in the Black Sea. And the Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks defending the Defense Department's strategy called integrated deterrence, an approach that uses both military and diplomatic power to make Russia and other adversaries think twice. America's employers added 428,000 jobs in April, writes the Associated Press, extending a streak of solid hiring that has defied punishing inflation, chronic supply shortages, the Russian war against Ukraine, and much higher borrowing costs. The economy's hiring gains have been strikingly consistent in the face of the worst inflation in four decades. Employers have added at least 400,000 jobs for 12 straight months. President Joe Biden spoke about the Labor Department's report as he visited Hamilton, Ohio, touring a factory run by United Performance Metals, which provides metals to other industries, aerospace, semiconductor, power generation, oil, and gas.
We know that one of the best ways to fight inflation is to bring prices down, and bring prices down is to strengthen the resilience of our supply chains. And that includes making more things here in America, at home, from top to bottom. And that's been my priority since day one. If I can slow here for just a second and point out that, you know, I didn't realize, I've been a senator for a long time, then a vice president for 8 years. I didn't realize there was an act passed back in 1939. It was called Buy American. I didn't know it existed. It's totally within the bounds of negotiated deals on trade. It says that when the president spends your money appropriated by the Congress, the president should only buy products or let contracts for things that are made in America, whether it's a deck of an aircraft carrier or it's a computer chip. Today's job report shows our plans and priorities have produced the strongest job creation in the modern times of the American economy. Today's report shows we created 428,000 jobs last month. And that means we have now created a total of 8.3 million jobs in my first 15 months in office with the help of the gentleman behind me. And the unemployment rate now stands at 3.6%, the fastest decline in unemployment in the start of a president's term ever recorded, again, because of the guys behind me. Black unemployment has been cut nearly in half since I took office. And unlike previous administrations, where the deficit went up, every single year we've reduced the deficit. Last year, with all we've done, we've reduced the deficit. Does this work? We reduced the deficit by a total of $350 billion. That's reduced the deficit last year. And this year, by the end of the fiscal year, by October 1st, we will reduce this year's deficit by $1.5 trillion. Never in the history of America has that happened before.
President Joe Biden at a manufacturing plant in Hamilton, Ohio. The gentlemen behind me that he mentioned include the two U.S. senators from Ohio, Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican Rob Portman, who is not running for re-election this year. President also in Ohio there to discuss the U.S. competition and innovation bill that Congress is still working on. It's designed to help American companies better compete globally, especially with China. And the president announcing that five major U.S. manufacturers are increasing their reliance on small and medium American firms for 3D printing. They are GE Aviation, Honeywell, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Siemens Energy. While the April jobs report is strong, inflation in the U.S. still running at levels not seen in four decades. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, focusing on that during an interview today on Fox Business.
So the truth is that the President Biden's policies, economic policies, have led to the worst inflationary effects in our economy in 40 years. That means that the average person in our country is experiencing an invisible tax that is eroding their spending power. That means our seniors who are on fixed income have to find a way to ration either their health care, their medicine, their energy, or food. It means that people who are growing up in households like the one I grew up in, they're now having to make harder decisions than they've ever had to make. That's wrong.
More on the April jobs report now with Josh Mitchell, reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being on Washington Today. The first line of your article reads that the U.S. economy added 428,000 jobs in April, a robust gain, suggesting the labor market remains hot despite jittery stock markets and a dimming economic outlook. Kind of a mixed bag there.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. So trouble is happening in China. Europe is going through a lot of trouble with the Russia invasion of Ukraine and high oil prices. Even we saw here in the United States, output fell in the first 3 months of the year. The stock market has fallen. And yet, employers are hiring like we're in boom times. And so something strange is going on. But I think the key to understanding what's going on is that a lot of households, a lot of consumers are going out and spending money, and employers are trying to hire people to serve them. So the U.S. jobs market is still very hot right now. And in fact, it would probably be even hotter if there were just more workers out there. That's the biggest obstacle to an even stronger labor market recovery. And a stronger U.S. economy is just if there were more workers out there that employers could bring onto their payrolls.
What is driving the stock markets not responding to the good economic news?
Well, the stock market is concerned about a few things. I mean, one of the biggest things is inflation. So the Federal Reserve, you know, is moving to raise interest rates. This week, it raised its benchmark interest rate by the most that it has since the year 2000. And that's because inflation is high. And so all of these things, you know, combine to, you know, show that, you know, prices are rising. So the economy and the labor market is pretty hot. And so the Fed is concerned that it's getting too hot. And so, you know, while the job market is strong, there is a concern that it's almost getting too strong, that, you know, if employers continue to have to raise wages, you know, that's going to fuel even further inflation, which will then fuel higher wage increases. And so there might be a cycle that will be hard to contain if it gets to that point. So investors are concerned about the interest rate increases, which if the Fed, you know, is not careful enough, and they're trying to be careful, could tip the economy into a downturn. The Fed thinks it can do it without entering a downturn, but that's the big question mark. There's also a lot of other things going on in the world. For example, you know, in China, they've imposed these very strict lockdowns because they're going through another wave of COVID-19. And that could ultimately lead to more supply disruptions, which ultimately could hurt economic growth in the U.S. So there's just a lot of storm clouds right now. But again, as of right now, the labor market is strong and employers are still trying to hire. And that's because consumers are still spending money.
And on top of that, there have been some polls that have just come out showing that the U.S. public has a pessimistic view of the economy. How does that fit in?
Right. So it's... Yeah, you know, again, that's what's weird. You know, I have a line in my story that says, look, all of these storm clouds have formed, and yet, you know, Americans are spending as though we're in boom times. And part of that is because, you know, household savings are still a little bit high, you know, because, you know, households saved money by not being able to travel over the past couple years. They got some stimulus money from Congress and unemployment insurance. And so overall household savings are still high, although that's coming down as prices rise. But people, you know, are eager, it seems, to go out to concerts again, to travel again. You know, these are things that they haven't done in the past couple of years. And so I think while, you know, for sure people are concerned about inflation, that's eating into their paychecks. They're still eager to have fun again. You know, this is a really rare circumstance where people have gone so long without doing the certain things that they have fun doing, and now they're actually starting to go out again.
We're talking with Josh Mitchell with the Wall Street Journal. The unemployment rate is right around the pre-pandemic level. Is the recovery complete?
No. So we're still down by about 1.2 million workers if you compare the level of unemployment last month to where it was in February 2020. And also keep in mind, if you include how much the population grew over that time, you know, we should actually have even more workers than our pre-pandemic levels. So the recovery is not complete. And here is the key to, I think, everything. It's the supply of workers. You know, we're close to where we were, but we're not quite up there yet. And the reason why is there's just several million workers who otherwise would be in the labor force, but they're not. And this is a puzzle. No one quite knows what's going on, but there's some indications that, you know, for example, a lot of people retired early over the pandemic. You know, some of them are unretiring and coming back, but, you know, so you have a cohort of older workers who decided to retire early. But then you have some prime age workers who, you know, there's recent research to show that there's just a lot of people who, even though the virus infections have come down very quickly this year, they're just still very scared of getting sick. We still have a virus out there. It's still possible to get sick. And so there's a lot of workers who are telling pollsters, you know, this is research out of Stanford, that, you know, even though, you know, the pandemic has faded, they still plan to maintain social distancing. They're essentially holing up in their homes because they're still scared of getting sick or passing the virus on to their loved ones. And so that is one of the biggest question marks facing the labor market and the economy and the Fed right now, which is when and if more people are going to come back into the labor force so that employers have an easier time finding workers.
Josh Mitchell, reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Find his story at WSJ.com and on Twitter at JMitchellWSJ. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
On Wall Street today, the Dow down 98, NASDAQ down 173, S&P down 23. Billionaire Elon Musk and Twitter are being sued by an Orlando, Florida police pension fund. They're aiming to stop Musk from completing his $44 billion takeover of the social media company before 2025. The suit was filed in Delaware and alleges that Delaware law forbids a quick merger because Musk had agreements with other large Twitter shareholders to support the buyout, including financial advisor Morgan Stanley and Twitter founder Jack Dorsey. Washington, D.C. just announced the creation of a new intelligence-led policing unit to confront violent crime in the nation's capital after a spate of shootings. They'll be partnering with the FBI and other federal agencies. Washington Examiner reports the new unit will use tactical and investigative strategies to target illegal firearms and dangerous people throughout the district and focus on linking suspects to firearms found at crime scenes using ballistics through a partnership with the BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Today, the Deputy U.S. Attorney General Lisa Monaco spoke at BATF headquarters at a Chiefs of Police Executive Forum on crime guns.
ATF is leading the way in using technology to leverage it and to help reduce violent crime and to help our partners in those efforts. Collecting and analyzing fired shell casings and crime guns is at the heart of identifying and solving gun crimes and arresting the shooters before they can strike again. It's precisely this intelligence that's derived from this data that can link shooting events to each other, to the perpetrators, identify those shooters in evidence-based, intelligence-led policing strategies. NIBIN, of course, provides timely ballistics information in what are very often very fast-moving investigations. And this is a unique resource that ATF can provide. And it's a unique resource for our law enforcement partners. The success and the growth of this tool is fueling ATF's expanded use of forensic science, data analytics, intelligence, and modern law enforcement research. And through eTrace, of course, law enforcement partners can directly submit firearms trace requests via the web to the National Tracing Center. Those same users can then receive those trace requests, search a database of firearms traces, and perform additional analysis. Using this data and using it together, investigators can uncover patterns for firearms trafficking, identify illegal and straw purchasers, and develop leads to recover firearms used in violent crimes. This is intelligence-led policing at its best, and I think our goal ought to be to get it into as many hands as possible. And although, as I understand it, firearms tracing by ATF is on the rise and is at record even in the last month, I'm told. Unfortunately, though, Marvin also tells me that only 51% of police departments are using these programs. So I have an ask of you today. And that ask is that each one of you is a voice to lift up the value of these programs, to spread the word on the benefits of participating in these programs. Because even if your particular case doesn't benefit from a particular piece of crime gun intelligence, you're adding to that pool of crime gun intelligence, I am sure, is going to help solve somebody else's case.
Deputy U.S. Attorney General Lisa Monaco at a conference at BATF headquarters in Washington. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, can run for re-election, according to a state administrative law judge who has thrown out a lawsuit claiming Greene engaged in insurrection by supporting the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and therefore violated the Constitution's ban on holding office, a provision that was adopted after the Civil War. The judge's recommendation will now be sent to the Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, also a Republican, who will be making the final decision on whether Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene can stand for re-election this November. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. This from Punchbowl News. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing the House will now require staff of members of Congress to be paid a minimum salary of $45,000. The maximum salary in the House for a staffer is $203,700, same as the Senate. House also plans a vote next week formally recognizing the right of congressional staffers to form a union. Social Security Administration out with the list of the most popular baby names for 2021. And again, it's Olivia for girls and Liam for boys. That's 3 years in a row for those two names. Rounding out the top five names for girls, Emma, Charlotte, Amelia, and Ava. And for boys, Noah, Oliver, Elijah, and James. Social Security finding that only one name changed in either top 10 list, the boy's name Theodore in 2021, replacing Alexander from 2020. From the New York Post, pro-choice abortion activists are calling on Americans to storm Catholic churches on Mother's Day to protest the potential overturning of landmark abortion decision Roe v. Wade. A pro-choice group called Ruth Sent Us, named after late liberal justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is urging followers on Twitter to rise up against a corrupt and illegitimate Supreme Court in the wake of Monday's bombshell leak of a draft opinion that could end nationwide abortion rights. The group tweeting, whether you're a Catholic for choice, ex-Catholic, or other, or no faith, recognize that six extremist Catholics set out to overturn Roe stand at or in a local Catholic church Sunday, May 8th. That tweet from that group. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki today asked whether the Biden administration is working with abortion rights organizations reacting to the draft Supreme Court opinion.
Can you give us a sense of whether or not the White House is in touch with women's groups about this? What is your engagement? What is the level of probably both frustration and anger out there at the Supreme Court and perhaps at the White House about this?
I'm not aware of anger at the White House. Others could speak to that. Obviously, this is a leaked, not final, opinion from the Supreme Court, right? So what our effort and our focus is on broadly engaging about the specifics on possible actions and preparing for the release of a final opinion when that is released early this summer. We are in conversations with a wide range of people, including women's groups, including pro-choice activists, including folks inside of D.C., outside of D.C., including business leaders, philanthropy, members of Congress, state legislatures, governors, advocacy groups across the board. We're using the convening power of the White House to talk to a broad range of groups. That effort is being led by the Gender Policy Council, which is coordinating work from the Department of Health and Human Services, from the White House Counsel's Office, from a range of from the Domestic Policy Council, from a range of officials in the government, working to see what our options are and what levers we have in government. I would note that we already took steps in reaction to SB 8 in Texas, and we will continue to build on them and prepare for a range of options. I'd also note that today we saw, or yesterday I should say, we saw that in Connecticut, Governor Lamont signed a bill that will protect medical providers and patients seeking abortion care in Connecticut who may be traveling from other states that have outlawed abortion. And additionally, the law expands abortion access in Connecticut by expanding the type of practitioners eligible to perform certain abortion-related care. So we're also here and available to states who are looking to take steps to protect women's rights. Obviously, our preference would be for Congress to codify Roe, and of course, for the final opinion not to look like the leaked opinion. But we are also supportive of states. We're going to work with a broad range of stakeholders as we prepare for a final opinion to be released.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki speaking with reporters on Air Force One. This from Fox News. Left-wing activist groups planning to send protesters to the homes of conservative Supreme Court justices following the leak indicating the court may soon overturn Roe v. Wade. The activists are organizing under the moniker Ruth Sent Us, and have published the supposed home addresses of Justices Amy Coney Barrett, John Roberts, Samuel Alito, Brett Kavanaugh, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch. Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Republican of South Carolina, reacting on the Fox and Friends First early morning program.
What was that experience like? And also, what's your reaction to the protests that are going to happen in front of the Supreme Court justices' homes?
Well, it's scary and it's dangerous. And I'm a single working mom with two kids. To have them have to walk out of the house and see FU, you know, to their mom and all the Antifa and anarchist symbology, it's really scary. It really, I think, jostled me for several months. And I carry a gun. I have like 7 firearms now, and I'll carry one of them anywhere I go. When I'm in South Carolina, we have open carry, but it's dangerous. Dangerous. And you always feel like you're looking over your shoulder. But now, seeing that they put a map out of the Supreme Court justices' residences and their homes, like, are they encouraging open season on our Supreme Court justices? Like, what's going on here? Yeah. And we know that, that these protests can turn into riots overnight very quickly. These people are very angry, and I support the right to peaceful protests and the right to free speech and saying what you want to say, but we should be discouraging this. This can be a very dangerous situation. We've seen this in pockets on and off over the last 2 years. COVID has exacerbated these situations, but we should have had, I think, more responsible remarks from the White House and Jen Psaki this week. It's almost encouraging this kind of behavior, and it should be discouraged.
No, absolutely. It's a sad state of things. It really is. What's happened is the partisanship of Congress has made its way to the Supreme Court. I'm old enough to remember during the Obama administration, the critique was we're legislating from the bench. Does Congress share some responsibility into this controversy? Not necessarily Roe versus Wade, but just how people have brought their passion to the Supreme Court, because they were knocking on the doors not that long ago, even before this.
No, that's right. But Congress now has a responsibility to get to the bottom of it and figure out and investigate who did this leak. I mean, it is having its intended effect. I believe it will further divide our country. And if violence breaks out, then we're going to see more division than we've seen in a very long time. And we need to be working for the American people and not working against each other, but working for each other.
Yeah. You said Congress shares responsibility. What about the White House?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, well, the language, the rhetoric that comes out of there and trying to discourage people. And that's not what you heard out of Jen Psaki or Joe Biden's administration this week. It sounded more like they were encouraging this and not discouraging it based on her remarks yesterday.
Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Republican, South Carolina, on Fox News Channel Friday morning. Now to Russia's war in Ukraine. A question to the Pentagon today about reports overnight that the U.S. gave Ukraine intelligence information to help it sink the Russian warship Moskva in the Black Sea. CBS News, citing a senior defense official, writing the U.S. shared the location of the Moskva, the Black Sea, with the Ukrainians, but had no role in the decision to strike it. Here's the question to the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
Return to the Moskva. Are there any restrictions that you can talk about that the U.S. would impose or include on Ukraine in its use of American intelligence so as not to, you know, risk further escalation of the conflict? And then secondly, there's a report out there about a second Russian patrol ship that's been struck, and Is there anything at all you can say about that?
Yeah, we've seen the reports about this second. I think they're saying the reporting out there, at least in social media, was a Russian frigate. We've been looking at this all day, and we have no information to corroborate those reports. On the intelligence, I think you can understand I'm going to be careful here in what we talk about in terms of the parameters of intelligence that we provide them. But we provide them what we believe to be relevant and timely information about Russian units that could allow them to adjust and execute their self-defense to the best of their ability. The kind of intelligence that we provide them, it's legitimate, it's lawful, and it's limited. And I would rather not get into what the degree to which there's limitations on there. But we try to be as timely and as relevant as we can. And I would also add, and this is not an unimportant point, we are not the only sole source of intelligence and information to the Ukrainians. They get intelligence from other nations as well. And they have a pretty robust intelligence collection capability of their own. I mean, they've been fighting this war against Russia for 8 years. It's not like they are completely blind to the way Russia organizes itself and the way that Russia conducts itself on the battlefield. So as you would expect any nation to do, they form a mosaic here. They collate the information that they're getting, and then they make their own decisions about what they're going to do with that. And if they do decide to do something with that intelligence, then they make the decisions about acting on it. Yeah.
Just on, I think when you were talking to the networks earlier today, you said the U.S. did not know beforehand that the attack on the Moskva was going to take place. I'm just curious, generally speaking, when the U.S. shares intelligence with the Ukrainians, does the U.S. ask what it's going to be used for, or is it just sort of handed over and said, do what you
want? Yeah, again, I want to be careful not to get into the specifics of the intel sharing. I think we can all understand why it's not good to have an open discussion about intelligence sharing. I would just go back to what I've said before. We try to provide them useful and relevant, timely intelligence so that they can better defend themselves. But ultimately, they make the decision about what they're going to do with that information, if anything.
So they don't give you a heads up saying, hey, we might...
We don't routinely get... no, we don't get... we don't get heads up about their day-to-day operations, nor do we expect to. I mean, they're in an active fight.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. Yesterday, he said anonymous reports that the U.S. supplied intelligence to Ukraine to help Ukrainian forces kill Russian generals was not true. This from AP. United Nations raced Friday to rescue more civilians from the tunnels under a besieged steel plant in Mariupol and the city at large, even as fighters holed up at the sprawling complex made their last stand to prevent Moscow's complete takeover of the strategic port. The fight for the last Ukrainian stronghold in the city reduced to ruins by the Russian onslaught appeared increasingly desperate amid growing speculation that President Vladimir Putin wants to finish the battle for Mariupol so he can present a triumph to the Russian people in time for Monday's Victory Day, the biggest patriotic holiday on the Russian calendar. That from AP. The U.S. has been pouring in weapons to Ukraine and will soon have a new tool when President Biden signs a bill into law reviving the Lend-Lease program first used to help Great Britain against Nazi Germany during World War II. Question about that today to the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby.
Separately, the Lend-Lease Act is supposed to be signed into law in the coming days. Can you talk about how that's going to change things here at the Pentagon? I mean, they say it's going to make it easier for the U.S. to get equipment and weapons to Ukraine, but what does that actually mean?
Yeah, we've talked about this a little bit before. It's not signed into law, and so unless or until the president decides to sign that, we're going to refrain from commenting on it. I would just back out a little bit and say, number one, we really do genuinely appreciate the support that we've gotten from Congress to allow us to continue to support Ukraine. And the president, as you saw just last week, asked for another $33 billion, $16 billion of which would affect the department specifically. And as you heard the secretary say, we urge the Congress to act quickly on that so that we can keep providing this support in an uninterrupted way. Additional support legislated by Congress and approved by the president certainly is going to be helpful. Any additional support that we can provide Ukraine is going to be helpful, but I'm going to refrain from speaking to the specifics of that pending legislation unless or until the president signs it.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters today. From Defense News, Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks on Friday defended the Biden administration's strategy of integrated deterrence against adversaries such as Russia, despite its invasion of Ukraine. Integrated deterrence seeks to dissuade adversaries from acting aggressively by using a wide range of tools available to the government. Those tools include joint military forces in all domains, a nuclear deterrent, sanctions, diplomacy, and a network of alliances and partnerships worldwide. Kathleen Hicks spoke today at the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington, D.C.
We seek to network our efforts across domains, theaters, and the spectrum of conflict to ensure that the U.S. military, in close cooperation with the rest of the U.S. government and our allies and partners, makes the folly and costs of aggression very clear. The combat credibility of the U.S. military to fight and win is the cornerstone of integrated deterrence. That is why our top-line request for fiscal year 23 includes $276 billion for procurement and for research, development, test, and evaluation. And that is across land, air, sea, cyber, and space, domains that must be netted together for integrated deterrence. Of note, across that spectrum of conflict, we also are investing $34.4 billion in recapitalizing the nuclear triad. Campaigning is our second approach, and it's related. Campaigning strengthens deterrence and enables us to gain advantage against the full range of competitors' coercive actions. The United States will operate forces, synchronize broader department efforts, and align department activities with other instruments of national power to undermine acute forms of competitor coercion, complicate adversaries' military preparations, and develop our own warfighting capabilities together with allies and partners. Readiness for the threats of today is central to campaigning, which is why we invest almost $135 billion in military readiness. And while we maintain the ability to respond across the globe, our campaigning efforts will be focused on the Indo-Pacific and Europe. Through the Pacific Deterrence Initiative and other regionally focused efforts, we make investments that support our comparative military advantage and bolster our posture and logistics in the Indo-Pacific region. Regarding Europe, our request supports the European Deterrence Initiative, U.S. European Command, and our ironclad commitment to NATO. America's ongoing support to the people of Ukraine exemplifies these priorities in Europe. As President Biden has stated, in the perennial struggle for democracy and freedom, Ukraine and its people are on the front lines. Thanks to the responsiveness of this administration and the United States Congress, we've already delivered over $4 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the start of the administration, and over $3 billion since the invasion on February 24th.
Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks, keynote address at a defense forum at the Ronald Reagan Institute in Washington. This from Reuters. The United States on Friday imposed sanctions on virtual currency Mixer Blender, accusing it of being involved in one of the largest cryptocurrency heists on record and being used by North Korea, the U.S. Treasury Department said. The department said it was the first time the U.S. imposed sanctions on a virtual currency Mixer, a software tool that pulls and scrambles cryptocurrencies from thousands of addresses, and said it would continue to investigate the use of Mixers for illicit purposes. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories sent to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.